Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy.
Kia ora, Dave. How are you this wonderful day?
Morena. Yep, not too bad. We're into March, and this is February's snippets, but March was a very short month. February was a very short month, so that's the reason.
Short and very full. But yeah, let's kick on. Let's get into it. What are the snippets for February 2022?
Well, we're moving around the body, really. So starting with the legs, pretty much. So this is a recent Tools for Practice article, and it's really getting back to basics around peripheral artery disease and the benefit of walking. So patients with peripheral arterial disease, exercise therapy improves maximum walking distance and pain-free walking distance by up to around 200 meters over 2 to 78 weeks. So it's quite a wide range of time input. But that's compared with usual care. So no benefits been demonstrated with respect to amputation or mortality. And they were looking at most commonly supervised walking 2 to 3 times a week for 30 to 60 minutes. So it's fairly basic treatment. But the interesting thing I thought was that in the study, 63% of patients identified walking as the primary cause of their pain, and 90% thought that walking would worsen their symptoms. So it's something that needs to be expressly talk to patients that they can essentially walk through their pain, and that will ultimately improve the circulation.
And there's good evidence to support that. So which is great to point people at. Do they keep walking through the pain?
Yeah, but I think they certainly walk to the onset of pain, and then in a supervised fashion increase the distance that they walk beyond that.
Yeah.
With the expectation that the time to pain will slowly stretch out.
Yeah.
Or the distance to pain will slowly stretch out.
Yeah. I always wondered why this wasn't the case for angina as well. You know, because the theory is that you're promoting the development of tributary sort of collaterals. Mm. And that does happen with angina, and that with heart disease as well. I know the risks are significant with angina. So asking people to keep on walking through their angina is not recommended, is it?
Not that I'm aware of, although I think it's because your heart, you know, you knock off a bit of thigh muscle is probably quite slightly different to knocking off a bit of heart
muscle. But,
but certainly, I mean, I've certainly seen operation reports where there's been massively developed collateral circulation with people that have gone in for a bypass or whatever. So
But just a word for a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. Don't extrapolate this to heart disease as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I think the interesting thing, it also reflects things like back pain, that people think if they're aggravating their back pain, they're doing themselves more harm, and that's the basis for being immobile rather than actually trying to mobilize through pain.
And lots of joint pains and, you know, osteoarthritis. The worst thing we do to patients is tell them that they've got bone on bone, and the this is progressive, and the next thing they're going to need is a joint replacement. You know, telling people that it's motion is lotion and keeping moving is the best form of therapy that you can have is really key, I think. And this is another illustration of that, I think.
Yeah, you certainly want them to be conditioned before any joint replacement surgery rather than being totally deconditioned beforehand. So moving from the legs kind of to the brain, I suppose, and this is just talking about the Medical Council statement on revised statement on electronic communication and the internet. I guess there's a word of warning around use of social media as a health professional, even your personal social media, that inappropriate communication including use of social media, can be considered unprofessional, whether it's directly related to the doctor's work or not.
Right.
So there is a potential, I guess, if you've got a reasonably public personal profile and are listing things on there like smoking dope at a party or whatever, that could come back to bite you from the medical council point of view.
I suppose this will relate to beliefs around complementary and alternative medicine. That you need to, if you carry those beliefs and it's something that you want to promote through your social media status, then as a doctor you have to caveat it with the professional statements around that as well. Because you carry that extra responsibility as a medic to meet all of our professional standards in all aspects of our life.
That's right. So I think even if you had two Facebook profiles, a professional one and a personal one, it just illustrates that people will still know you are a doctor, even if you're not declaring yourself to be a doctor. So if you come out with massive non-evidence-based anti-vax statements, for instance, on your personal profile, that could still
come back
to bite you.
Yeah.
So just caution there. But there are some other...
Well, thank you, Dave. I don't have anti-vax statements, but I do have a social media profile. But thanks for the warning.
Pictures of you drunk or vomiting or whatever. But the some other interesting statements within this electronic communication recommendation. So things like, they say, patients who get information from the internet may wish to discuss this with you. You should use this as an opportunity to talk about how sometimes the information obtained from these sources may be of poor quality, incorrect, or create unrealistic expectations. So I think it's what we'd all love to do. I don't know whether many of us have the time to actually do that when we're presented with 80 pages of Dr. Google. But
you can do a lot with body language and a roll of the eyes, can't you?
Yeah. I think in some complaints I get around this issue, I get the patient's, not sure if it's always an accurate perception or accurate recollection, but basically the doctor threw the pages back at them and said it was rubbish or something like that. So there are other ways of presenting your views. So they say provide sound reasons for the views you express, and where possible provide documentation to support the alternative advice or treatment that you are recommending.
I did have a colleague who said that how he dealt with these things was he would say, oh, that's interesting. He'd take the papers off the patient, have a quick look at them, rip them up and throw them in the bin, and then say, what was it that you wanted to ask me about? So that was, he was probably browning out at the time. So,
yes.
Yeah, not the ideal way of dealing with it.
Not totally recommended, no. You might expect some feedback.
Yeah.
And the other thing they touch on is security issues related to use of email, which I think most of us now, if we're communicating by email, it's through the patient portal, which is secure. But I still do get complaints about people that have sent usually clinical information into a generic practice email, which was then not answered for 2 days, or that they're concerned because an administrative person looked at it or whatever. So I think a reminder that we shouldn't be using non-secure email for clinical matters unless absolutely necessary.
There is good advice on the ministry website around how to check if your email meets the security requirements, and it's a fairly straightforward online check. And most of the email that we use, if we're using Office 365 or and those sort of programs, it does meet the requirements of security, basic security. Mm-hmm. But then there's the practice of not referring to the patient in identifiable terms in the subject line and those sorts of other things that you just need to get your head around not doing. If you're sending a document which is a list of patient identifiable details, then make it password protected and text the person who's receiving it the result, the password to access the document, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
The common one that comes up is ACC, asking for and sharing information via a practice email. I think the advice I've had on that is that if it's an individual patient, it's done through a secure email system, then it's okay. But I understand why people would like to take some extra steps in terms of that patient privacy.
Yeah, I think being overcautious is certainly better than risking being brought before the privacy commissioners.
So, yeah.
Moving down the body a little to the genital region, we've got some recently updated Aotearoa New Zealand STI management guidelines. So quite a lot of interesting information in there, but I've just chosen chlamydia this month. So there's growing evidence that sexually transmitted chlamydia establishes a persistent rectal reservoir that is refractory to treatment with statin azithromycin. So very strong for men who have sex with men, but growing for women as well. And the latest guidelines are abandoning statin azithromycin and reverting to doxycycline 100 BD for 7 days as the first choice of treatment with statin azithromycin only if doxy is contraindicated or the patient is highly likely to be non-adherent.
I understand this is unrelated to the sexual practices as well, so that it doesn't rely on anal sex for this reservoir to develop.
That's right. I mean, I certainly higher incidence in those populations that practice anal sex regularly, but not reliant on that to exist. But the other interesting thing is that if you've got symptomatic anorectal infection and you isolate chlamydia on a rectal swab, it's highly likely to be other organisms involved, including lymphogranuloma venereum, and that generally requires, or symptomatic anorectal infection, they say, generally requires specialist advice regarding further testing and management because of the complexities of management.
So presumably that would be pain, inflammation,
pain discharge. So that was, I thought that was interesting, and there are other updates within the document which I might look at some later stage. Recurrent BV, bacterial vaginosis, staying in the genital region. So that's I don't work that many hours a week, but it's something I see, you know, even in my limited working time, women complaining of recurrent BV.
Yeah.
And there was a recent article in New Zealand Doctor that brought out some key points which weren't overly helpful, but which you probably know about. But basically, there have been no major advances in treatment or cure of BV. Standard therapy is still 7 days of twice daily metronidazole, but many women have tried that and are looking for alternative treatments. And they talk about intravaginal boric acid capsules have been used historically and may be considered an alternative, though unfunded, treatment to use in conjunction with antibiotic therapy. So boric acid, it's been around for years and years. I used to have a puffer that I puffed boric acid into people with ears with otitis externa, that I inherited from the GP I bought my practice off.
My goodness.
It's also used in ant poison. I looked through, I looked online, I couldn't actually find a boric acid vaginal pessaries certainly aren't available funded. They can be bought online for $199 for 72 capsules, which is about 5 courses. But DermNet New Zealand also has an article on BV, and it talks about some other alternative treatments, including gels to reduce vaginal pH and a vaginal antiseptic, Dequalinium, which used to be Dequidin throat lozenges. I don't know if you remember those, but they were, they used to be around. Anyway, most of these I can't see that you can actually get in New Zealand, although you can get Essigel, which is available over the counter for about $30 per 100 gram tube. And that's what I generally tend to use to advise. So looking at alternatives, so in 2009, there was a Cochrane review that concluded that there was no conclusive evidence for probiotics in the treatment of BV, but a 2019 meta-analysis concluded that probiotic regimes are safe and may exhibit a short-term and long-term beneficial effect for BV treatment. And there are a heap of OTC probiotic preparations available under various names for and advertised for BV use. And this is generally oral treatment rather than vaginal pessaries or whatever.
It's such a heterogeneous term probiotic, isn't it?
That's right. So, and the studies have been done on specific strains, which may not be present in all of these over-the-counter preparations. But I think often when we get into that stage, it's, you know, if the patient's prepared to spend $20 on a couple of months of probiotic capsules, well, there's not much to lose. I wouldn't have thought.
Taken orally?
Taken orally, generally, yeah. But there's another condition, getting back to the use of acygel, that I hadn't heard of, but Dermot also talked about cytolytic vaginosis as a cause of persistent vaginal discharge. So that's actually a result of a hyperacidic vaginal environment, which acygel would make worse. Mm. And it's related to an overgrowth of lactic acid-producing bacilli rather than lack of lactic acid-producing bacilli. So the management in that condition is aimed at reducing vaginal pH, and they recommend douching with baking soda.
My.
So persistent vaginal discharge, I guess, if BV doesn't seem to be the issue, don't necessarily use acygel because you could make it worse. And maybe consider whether the cytolytic vaginosis could be a possible cause as well.
I'm vaguely remembering when I worked in an STI clinic as a SHO, actually having litmus paper and checking the acidity of vagina.
Yeah, so that's one strategy that they recommended here in terms of distinguishing between the two.
Yeah.
So, although I'm not sure where you'd buy litmus paper from these days. I haven't seen it around for a long time.
I don't know, a brewer's shop maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting. Cytolytic vaginosis. Yeah, yeah. Staying in the kind of uterine region. Again, this one's not uncommon knowledge. Extended use of intrauterine devices, just that the evidence, the more evidence coming out, again, this is through Tools for Practice, around extending the use of copper and levonorgestrel intrauterine devices beyond the manufacturer recommendations. So the conclusion of the studies they looked at were if it is not possible or desirable to replace a levonorgestrel 52 milligram or copper T388 intrauterine device at the end of the approved duration of use, small observational studies demonstrate a similar efficacy and safety for up to 2 additional years with little evidence afterwards. Most guidelines suggest that with patient-informed discussion, deferral of IUD replacement for up to 12 months is reasonable. So essentially between 12 months and 2 years, it seems there's no fall off in efficacy or safety. However, because the manufacturer recommendations are quite specific, if you're going to actually leave it in for an extra year or a couple of years, I think it's important to document you've discussed this with the patient. And it's an evidence-based agreed decision that you're going to leave it in for a bit longer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if it's not possible or desirable, what patients want and what patients need are sometimes, that's one of the challenges that we have as medics, and to sort of breach that that conversation. So the issues that might cause that delay, I presume, we need to be really clear about documenting what it is they are, and that it's a mutually agreed, transparent process around that. It's not just we're very busy at the moment, so come back next year.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be maybe something like somebody going overseas for 6 months, perhaps, or
that type of
thing.
An intercurrent illness, a bereavement, something that's going to be significantly impacting, somebody who's been sexually assaulted, for goodness sake, there's so many other issues around, the removal of the IUD that might be complicating that decision.
Certainly documentation, I think, and documenting that it's been discussed and consent obtained for leaving it in longer is important.
Yeah.
BPAC referred to an antipsychotic switching tool that's available from NPS Australia. that I had a look at it online. It's quite practical if you are looking at swapping antipsychotics, changing preparations, but I think the application to primary care is probably quite limited because we're not generally swapping from oral to parenteral antipsychotics in primary care, or necessarily swapping between clozapine and olanzapine or vice versa ourselves. The only application I could think was maybe in aged care if we're looking at risperidone versus quetiapine and swapping around those preparations. But again, the dose range that they are talking about in the antipsychotic switching tool are really the doses you'd be using for psychosis rather than for then BPSD, for example. So I think it's of limited usefulness in primary care, but there's a link to the tool in the snippets.
Yeah, I mean, the availability of the support from the psychiatrists is variable as well. So, you know, actually having something you can go and say, you know, I'm wondering if this would be the next step for us might help with that shared decision making with the psychiatrist, just using advice only referral. Yeah. So I think, you know, could definitely support that. So the link will be there in the show notes.
The link's in the notes. Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah.
And
you're incredibly broad in your reading, Dave.
I've come back to brain again, haven't I? And the last one's kind of brain as well. And this relates really to complaints I see quite regularly around often patients thinking they've had serotonin syndrome secondary to what they perceive to be a prescribing error, but often it's just they've Googled and found out that the medications they've been prescribed have placed them at potential risk of serotonin syndrome. So it's really common to see, even in complaints unrelated to prescribing, people being prescribed more than one serotonergic agent. Yeah. And I don't think I've ever seen in the notes that the potential risk of serotonin syndrome, or that they are being prescribed two serotonergic agents, and the potential risks of this have ever been discussed. So the complaints usually that they weren't warned of the risk of serotonin syndrome, or that they had serotonin syndrome, although I've never actually seen that the criteria for that diagnosis have ever been fulfilled. But the most common combinations I see being prescribed are tramadol added to an SSRI, SNRI, or TCA, when a TCA is added to an existing antidepressant regime to help them sleep or whatever. And there was a 2015 communication from MedSafe, which I've linked in the snippets, which discusses the issue in more detail and well worth a quick review. Tramadol, I think, is often added to SSRIs, particularly people with chronic pain syndromes, when they're often on an SSRI anyway, or vice versa, quite frequently a cause for complaint, even if there's been no harm actually done.
I would be pretty confident that I would have warned people if I was considering doing that. I would have verbally warned them and maybe sort of said, you know, look, take half a tablet the first time that you take it, and these are things to watch out for. Particularly with adding tramadol, because I think even the first time you take tramadol alone can you know trigger off really quite odd feelings. But whether I've recorded that in the notes or not is another question. It's one of these things where you quite often, you know, you tell people things, but you don't necessarily write down, I told them this.
Yeah.
I've certainly found that printing out the medication advice sheet from the New Zealand formulary and giving that to patients, particularly when you're giving a new medication, a really good practice to get into. But again, I couldn't honestly say I consistently record that I've done that. And I know it doesn't record it in the PMS that it's been done when you've, you know, doing it from an external site.
That's right. Which is, I mean, it would be really nice for something like that to be incorporated into a PMS. I know I'm looking at another complaint recently about whether somebody was given information around a surgical procedure and they were meant to have been given a pamphlet and the pamphlet has a sticky label, and you just peel the sticky label off the pamphlet and stick it in the notes, which proves you've given them the pamphlet. But something like that that's easy to do, which just reinforces what's been given, would be would be helpful, I think.
Yeah. We're going to have to give some thought to how we can make that happen. Yeah. But
or even a hotkey. Not that I'm a great fan of hotkeys, but a hotkey in that instance could be handy.
Yeah. No, that's great. So it's from the legs to the head to the genitals, back to the head again.
Back to the head, that's the body this week.
Trip around the body. Thanks, Dave. That's absolutely brilliant. So the once again, thanks for the work you do developing these, and we'll see you again later on this month.
Yeah, before at least it's a long month, so it will feel very long for some people too, I think, but we'll get there.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.